The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 8, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large block capital lettering, is in gradations of gray to beige. It's superimposed upon a dark brown to lighter tan background, which is a wall, presumably of a home. I'll read the caption on the cover first. All we have left is fear. The U.S. was the largest humanitarian supporter of the Afghan people. Then the funding was slashed. Now, other than the rather bland background of the brown to shades of tan, the foreground's rather colorful. There's a rug, or I should say a floor covering. I don't know if it's a rug. It's in bright red with blue and white dots throughout. Seated on her knees on the floor covering is a woman. She's wearing a black and brown plaid dress, but she's wearing a bright red bordered in gold and tan colors scarf. Her face is visible, but not her hair. She has very dark eyes. She's looking at, actually penetrating the camera with them. And to her left, to our right, as I'm describing this, is a baby. And the baby is in a type of cradle that I've never seen before. It's quite low to the ground. It's made of something sturdy. It looks like wood. It's rather rustic looking. It's not a shiny, polished finish at all. But the baby's lying very sedately in this little contraption, and it seems to be tied in with colorful strips of perhaps ribbon or cotton, and the baby's looking right at the camera with its brown eyes, and it's has quite a head of hair in dark colors. There's a handle at the top of this, what I'm describing as a cradle, and draped over that handle is kind of a blanket, or I guess something to protect the baby. It's in shades of gray and tan. Then behind the woman, she's actually leaning on what appears to be a stack of either bolts of cotton or perhaps they're folded blankets, because one of these items does look like the baby's crib or cradle covering. But these bolts of fabric or blankets or quilts or something are very brightly colored. They're purple and red and blue and kind of a blue-white figure, and then a blue-green with orange and red, and then that dull color, but it does have a print in it, like the baby's cradle covering, and then more green and red and beige. So I don't know what this woman has at her her back, actually. She's not leaning on it. She's sitting up quite straight on the floor. So on to the first article, which is really a photograph, and it says morning in Gaza. That does not mean the time of day. It means mourning, as in grief-stricken, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, in Gaza. It is absolutely shoulder-to-shoulder, elbow-to-elbow crowd of I'm seeing all men. If there's a female in there, I'm not seeing her. And these men are dressed differently. The guy in front has a black cap, and he's wearing dark clothing, but there's something that looks like a bulletproof vest on his chest, and it has PRESS, P-R-E-S-S, in large lettering. Most of the men have casual shirts. I don't see any of the trousers, so I can't describe that. We're seeing all head shots to waist shots. Dark-colored T-shirts, long-sleeved shirts, plaid shirts. They all have very dark hair. Some are wearing caps. One says Adidas and one says NY, like the Yankees logo. But the crowd extends from the very front of the camera's field, where the person wearing the press vest is, extending all the way into the background. It's just a huge crowd. On either side are buildings. They look like concrete, but there's a lot of canvas, too. So I don't know if the canvas is part of the building construction or if there are stalls made of the canvas in front of these buildings. Very far in the background, there's a pale, almost icy blue sky. And the caption reads thus, "Mourners carry the body of Anas al-Sharif at his funeral in Gaza City, August 11. The Al Jazeera correspondent, whom Israel had called a terrorist without providing evidence, was killed along with several of his colleagues in an airstrike on a tent housing journalists and media workers. Nearly 200 members of the press have been killed in the conflict, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists." So, what I'm seeing in terms of canvas is perhaps a tent or many tents for housing journalists. And sure enough, behind those first two layers of men in the photo, there is a white shroud. And that would be the body that's being carried. Moving then to the next short article, the bulletin, ICE, Lone Star Lockup, Mega Detention Facility, opens. This is by Solsira Burga. A detention center poised to become the largest of its kind in the U.S. opened on a military base in El Paso, Texas, August 17. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said it was an effort to decompress ICE detention facilities in other regions. More than $1 billion will be invested in the Fort Bliss Center to expand its current 1,000-bed capacity to 5,000. Dubbed Lone Star Lockup, its opening is part of the Trump administration's effort to use military bases and personnel to enforce immigration rules. A Washington Post report found ICE plans to add more than 41,000 detention beds in 2025, nearly doubling its capacity from the start of the year, to deliver on the American people's mandate for mass deportations. Assistant Homeland Security Secretary Tricia McLaughlin said in a statement to Time, "Funding comes from the One Big Beautiful Bill, which included the largest detention and deportation investment in U.S. history, per the American Immigration Council. Passed in July, the bill allocated $45 billion for immigration detention, a 265% increase to ICE's detention budget. Homeland Security Chief Kristi Noem is exploring purchasing a fleet of airliners for deportations rather than chartering flights," NBC News reported August 20. Fort Bliss served as a Japanese internment camp during World War II and more recently as an emergency shelter for thousands of unaccompanied migrant children during the Obama and Biden administrations. In 2021, two federal employees filed a whistleblower complaint alleging mismanagement of child care and public health and safety concerns. Immigrants' rights advocates cited desert temperatures and an isolation too designed to break people down, strip away hope, and pressure them into giving up their cases, wrote the ACLU's Hattie Gassama. The mega facility opened despite the El Paso County Commission unanimously passing a resolution in early August opposing it. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas countered the criticisms, calling the center humane and safe. Turning the page to the brief news, good question. Why are so many people leaving the workforce? By Alana Samuels. 212,000, that's how many women ages 20 and over have left the U.S. workforce since January, according to the most recent jobs numbers released August 1 by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. By contrast, 44,000 men of the same age have entered the workforce since January. The numbers are especially stark for women with children. From January to June, the labor force participation rate of women ages 25 to 44 living with a child under 5 fell nearly 3 percentage points, from 69.7% to 66.9%, says Misty Lee Hegness, an associate professor of economics and public affairs at the University of Kansas. It is a big reversal. The participation of those women had soared in 2022, 2023, and 2024, peaking in January 2025 as flexible work policies helped women join the workforce and generate much-needed income for their families. This year, workers have seen flexibility revoked on a large scale. President Donald Trump ordered federal employees back to the office 5 days a week in January, and Amazon, J.P. Morgan, and AT&T also returned to five-day-a-week policies in 2025. Overall, full-time, in-office requirements among Fortune 500 companies jumped to 24% in the second quarter of 2025, up from 13% at the end of 2024, according to the Flex Index, which tracks remote work policies. It is not a coincidence that women's participation in the workforce is falling as flexibility disappears, says Julie Votman, Senior Director of Job Quality for the National Women's Law Center. Women capitalized on remote work and flexibility during the pandemic and stopped exiting the labor force, research shows. Not many are able to do so. Not many are not able to do so. Women still take the lion's share of caregiving responsibilities, and they're more likely than men to be navigating how to meet those caregiving responsibilities while holding down a job, she says. They're also more likely than men to feel they have to leave the workforce when their balancing act becomes unmanageable. The disappearance of flexibility is not the only reason women are leaving the workforce in 2025. Some of the decline in participation comes because federal dollars for child care have declined significantly in 2025. That money helped many centers stay open and charge lower tuition than they otherwise would have. The federal funding helps some providers keep their costs down. Now, child care expenses are rising again. You have a population of working women who are finding it increasingly difficult to make the math work, Votman says. As women leave the workforce, the Trump administration is exploring ways to encourage women to slow the country's decline in birth rate. But Hegness says the return to office policies may be making some women put off having children. What they're doing right now with the return-to-work policies and their leading by example is the exact opposite of what you would want to be doing from a policy perspective if you really care about increasing birth rates, Hegna says. There are bigger reasons to be concerned about women leaving the workforce. Without two incomes, many families struggle to afford basics like housing, food, and transportation. They have less money to spend, which means less money circulating in the economy. Economic growth has slowed in the first half of the year. In the long term, slowing growth worsens people's standard of living. For many women, this is more than an economic problem. It is a depressing reminder that the brief period of time when work from home reigned, when balancing family and work was actually sometimes possible, is over. Big picture, women's labor force participation has stalled in the U.S. in recent decades, peaking in the early 2000s, even as it rose in many countries in Europe. But then, during the pandemic, rates started rising again as women could handle caregiving responsibilities while working from home. When I hear about these companies making everyone go back to the office, the most normal situation is it is being ordered by some old white male person with what I call care privilege, says Hegnus, which is that they have someone who cooks their meals, irons their clothes, or picks their kids up from daycare. Here's a milestones page. There are two main columns with an additional five thumbnail sketches here. Died Terence, that's T-E-R-E-N-C-E, Stamp, S-T-A-M-P. Smoldering Actor by Chad de Guzman. There's a small inset photo here in black and white of a very serious-looking young man. Hair is slightly long around the face. I can't see what it's like in the back. It looks blondish-brown, but it is a black-and-white photo. He's wearing a cravat with a figurative white on dark pattern, and he's wearing, all one sees are the shoulders of a dark jacket. British actor and memoirist Terence Stamp died August 17 at age 87, leaving behind an extraordinary body of work, both as an actor and a writer, that will continue to touch and inspire people for years to come, his family said in a statement. Stamp first gained global renown with his performance in Billy Budd, 1962, for which he earned a Best Supporting Actor Oscar nomination. As his fame soared in the 1960s, he was in the mix to lead the James Bond franchise. Later, Stamp was most recognized for portraying villain General Zod in Superman, 1978, and Superman II, 1980, as well as for starring in the 1994 cult classic, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And the next longer article is another died, Jim Lovell, L-O-V-E-L-L, The Hard Luck Moon Man by Jeffrey Kluger. There's a larger photo here in color of Lovell in younger years. He's wearing his NASA space suit. It's white with all kinds of gadgetry on the front. The U.S. flag is shown on his left shoulder. He's standing next to what appears to be a globe of the moon. It doesn't look like Earth. And behind him, a backdrop showing, oh, perhaps the Milky Way. It looks like some kind of a galaxy with lots of bright dots on it, with blue and red tones. It is one of history's great, oh, this is by Jeffrey Kluger. It is one of history's great injustices that circumstance denied Jim Lovell the moon. Once the most experienced man in spaceflight, with two trips in the Gemini program and two lunar missions in Apollo, Lovell, who died August 7 at 97, went places few others have gone and saw things few others had seen. But he never had the opportunity to get his white NASA-issued moon boots dirty with gray lunar soil. Lovell is best remembered, of course, not for those two Gemini missions, which he flew in Earth orbit, or even for the Apollo 8 mission, which saw him and crewmates Frank Borman and Bill Andrews become the first humans to orbit the moon on Christmas Eve, 1968. What he's best known for is Apollo 13, a mission he commanded in April 1970, which was intended to be America's third lunar landing until an explosion in one of the lunar orbiter's oxygen tanks crippled the spacecraft, forcing the crew to use their flimsy lunar module as a lifeboat and paddle their way back to Earth. "Houston, we have had a problem," Lovell famously intoned in the moments after the explosion, reporting the incident as if it were nothing more troubling than the family car running out of windshield washer fluid. It was that preternatural cool that enabled Lovell to turn what might easily have been a fatal accident into one of NASA's greatest tales of ingenuity and survival. Lovell made peace with his place in space history, never raising his hand for a third try at the moon, lest he deny a seat to other astronauts still competing for limited spots on limited flights. And he would not subject his wife Marilyn, whom the exploding oxygen tank nearly widowed, to one more launch, one more mission, one more roll of the mortal dice. Apollo 13, Lovell liked to say, was a successful failure. America ultimately came to see it as an unalloyed triumph. Lovell, as commander, was the author of that story. All right, at the bottom of the page now, these marginally readable little items, CAMPED, that's C-A-M-P-E-D. Democratic State Representative Nicole Collier in the Texas Capitol, starting August 18 in a protest against state Republicans' effort to pass a redrawn congressional map. Returned Pierre Poilievre, leader of Canada's Conservatives, to Parliament in a by-election after the shocking April loss of a seat he'd held for 21 years. Sentenced hip-hop artist Sean Kingston to 3.5 years in prison August 15 after being convicted in a federal fraud case involving luxury merchandise. Discontinued AOL's dial-up internet service and its associated software by September 30. The company announced the move on its help portal August 8. Killed at least 277 people during a weekend of flash flooding in Pakistan, the Associated Press reported August 18. About 150 people were still missing. Turning the page now to a double spread photo, I'll start with the background. It's easy. Blue sky with white clouds. Okay, now I'll read the caption. Now remember, this is two pages. It's large. It's colorful. D.C., National Guard troops congregate near the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., August 17. President Donald Trump announced August 11 that the federal government was temporarily taking control of the city's police force and that he was deploying the National Guard on the streets of the nation's capital. Trump cited violent crime as justification for the move, which is a rare and controversial exercise of presidential power, even though data show violent crime is down in the city. Photo credits go to Julia Demarie Nickinson, AP. Okay, Lincoln Memorial's in the background in front of that beautiful blue sky, right? Lincoln Memorial. One sees its white and grayishness with all of the columns surrounding the portico. Now, down below that, and off to the left, there's a great big National Guard truck. It looks like a garbage truck, but it's probably a lot larger, and maybe not larger. Our garbage trucks around here are pretty big. And on the front, it says DC ARNG 74th. And then it says TC 104th HQ 02. It's in kind of a tan color. And then next to the big truck, a group of 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 National Guard's people, both men and women, wearing the camouflage uniform of the Guard in the kind of khaki, tan, variously muted colors of that, with caps on, women and men, and they're in a group. They're clustered together. It looks like one individual is speaking to the rest of them. And then behind them, in front of the huge high fence in front of the Lincoln Memorial, there are two United States Park police vehicles. So that is the story of that large double spread photograph. Turning the page again to the brief health. 5 Ways to Make Small Talk When You Have Social Anxiety, by Angela Haupt. When you have social anxiety, walking into a room full of people can make you feel like every eyeball in the place is boring directly into your soul, and nothing you say will possibly be smart or funny or coherent enough. That can trigger an array of physical, cognitive, and emotional symptoms. For some people, it might mean a racing heart and dizziness and feeling flushed, says Kirsten Hall Baldwin, a licensed clinical professional counselor in Chicago. Others might be in these thought spirals or feel like their mind is going blank or freezing. Hall Baldwin coaches her anxious clients to create a coping plan, a proactive list of strategies and techniques that can help temper their unease. Here, she and other experts share tips on how to carry a conversation when you have social anxiety. 1. Practice in low-stakes settings. Before showing up at a networking event or your 10-year high school reunion, try making conversation with baristas, waiters, neighbors, or coworkers. These short interactions can be a low-pressure way to build self-esteem. Smaller, manageable social interactions do not carry as much emotional weight, Hall Baldwin says. There is not necessarily a goal of having a deeply meaningful conversation, so it is just trying to practice without feeling overwhelming pressure. Over time, you will gain a sense of comfort and confidence as you venture into larger social settings. 2. Script some go-to phrases. Come up with and rehearse 2 or 3 simple conversation starters you can employ when your brain starts sputtering. That way, you will have something in your back pocket to continue the conversation, says Caroline Finkel, chief clinical officer with the virtual mental health platform Charlie Health. You can keep it going without having to freeze and leave to go to the bathroom. One of her favorites? That's really interesting. Tell me more about that. If you love traveling, ask people if they've gone on any recent vacations. Or if you're a foodie, find out if your conversation partner has tried any great new restaurants. 3. Use the echo technique. One of the best habits for someone with social anxiety is paraphrasing what the other person said and then encouraging them to elaborate. For example, if they mention they're struggling at work, repeat back their words with a question in your voice, "Struggling?" They will most likely launch into an explanation of what is giving them a hard time. People want to feel heard, Hall Baldwin says. A lot of the time, just showing attentiveness can encourage the other people to keep sharing. and that takes some of the pressure off you to feel like you have to come up with original responses. 4, find an anchor. Holding a cold drink, touching an object like a fidget toy, or simply pressing your feet into the floor can give your nervous system something to anchor to when you're feeling anxious. Research suggests it can bounce you back to the present moment and curb feelings of anxiety. It helps signal to your brain, "I'm safe," Finkel says. When she does public speaking engagements, she puts a worry stone into her pocket, which is a smooth, oval-shaped gem with a thumbprint-like indentation. "Every time I get nervous, I just touch it," she says. Doing so creates a physical sensation of security that propels her to the finish line. 5, have an exit strategy ready. The good news about social events is they all eventually end, and your departure can arrive as soon as you would like. You might feel better if you let your friends know from the start you have an early morning and will be able to stay only until a certain time, or make it clear you have an afternoon appointment that will keep brunch from turning into dinner. It's also a good idea to brainstorm a few ways to politely wrap up conversations, Hall Baldwin says. For example, "It was really nice talking to you. I'm going to check in with Jane." Doing so can help reduce anxiety about feeling trapped in a conversation, she says. 2, the cover story, headlined "World, I'm Afraid, What U.S. Aid Cuts Mean for the Women of Afghanistan." Photographs and text by Elise Blanchard. Well, again, here we are with that brownish, tannish colored wall. There are two people lying on the floor, sleeping. Well, maybe not sleeping, but prone and resting, apparently. There's a woman. She's wearing blue, and her blue scarf has fallen behind her head a bit. She has black hair, and her eyes are barely open, so maybe she is snoozing. And next to her is a baby who is asleep with his or her black hair all slicked down on his or her little head. The baby's lying on a little mattress kind of thing that looks like it has pink mice on it. And the baby is covered in what appear to be either blankets or lightweight bunches of fabric in pink and blue and green. There's some kind of baggage or supplies stacked next to the wall by these people. No labels except something that says ACE, whatever that means. Over the past 12 years, the small family health clinic in Melmastock, a remote mountainous community in Afghanistan's central Dikundi province, has withstood multiple upheavals from a Taliban insurgency to the withdrawal of international troops and the collapse of the U.S.-backed government in Kabul in 2021. Ever since, as the Taliban returned to power, once again issuing edicts to suppress women and girls, the clinic and its 34-year-old midwife, Atifa, have continued to provide a lifeline for mothers and young children until this summer, that is. Come July, the clinic finally closed its doors. For Atifa, who identifies herself like many local women with only her first name, that means one thing: mothers and children will die. The reason? The wholesale slashing by Washington of U.S. humanitarian aid. Until recently, the single biggest source of development support for ordinary Afghans. That support had been critical for the survival of health and other development projects in the country. Flowing in via the UN and its partners, But as of August this year, funding cuts have led to the suspension or closure of 422 health facilities in the country. Justifying the cuts, a senior Trump administration official cited reports of attempts to disrupt aid by the country's Taliban authorities. The reductions include 21 family health clinics in Dikundi, among them Atifa's, officially known as family health houses, and staffed by solitary midwives like Atifa, a cleaner, and a guard. The clinics provided care to women and children in areas where communities have no access to other health facilities. Nationwide, more than 100 such clinics have closed as a result of the cuts. The impact in many cases has been devastating. In April, Ali Hassan rushed his pregnant wife, Mariam, to their local family health house in Taiko, another remote Dikundi community, when she complained of pain and believed she was close to giving birth. It was only after waiting for the midwife for several hours they realized the clinic had been closed. The midwife had been laid off. Desperate for medical attention, they headed for a district hospital around 5 hours' drive away. It was too far. Both Miriam, 38, and their child succumbed shortly after they reached the hospital. There was a chance we could have saved both mother and child, or at least the mother, had the clinic been open, Sadiqa, a midwife at the district hospital, told Time. The hospital director, Eztala Alizada, agreed, adding, "These women live far away, and sometimes labor begins en route. By the time they arrive, they're close to dying." Globally, the trend has been going in the other direction. Years of interventions by local and international bodies mean women today are more likely than in the recent past to survive childbirth, with maternal mortality, or the deaths of women per 100,000 live births, declining by 40% from 2000 to 2023, according to the World Health Organization, WHO. The cuts could push Afghanistan, already suffering from comparatively high levels of maternal deaths, further in the other direction. Nearly two-thirds of global maternal deaths occur in countries like Afghanistan that are affected by fragility or conflict, the WHO says. As Khurshid, a 30-year-old pregnant woman in Dikundi, told Time, "All of us are afraid we or our children might die." Beyond pregnant women, the clinics also provided care for young children, and their closures have led to fear among many, like Mariam, a 24-year-old in Dikundi, with three young children. She used to have four. Last year, she lost her 5-month-old daughter when the child fell sick. Unable to afford a taxi, Mariam was walking to the nearest clinic, located about an hour on foot from her home, when the child died. Now the nearest health facility is more than twice as far away, even by car. The winter, when the region is buried under snow, restricting movement, she tells Time, is even scarier. For midwives, the closures have robbed them of their livelihoods in what remains a severely depressed economy. "I am getting weaker and older every day," Ghul Shaman, a midwife in Dikundi's Waras Valley, told Time, fearful of what would happen once she had exhausted her savings. "I am afraid for me and my children's future." Atifa, the midwife in Melmastock, is also afraid. She says she no longer even has supplies to work privately. "It simply is not safe," forcing her to turn away former patients like Sogra, a young woman in her 30s, who a week before Atifa's clinic shut down told Time she was terrified about giving birth. Tragically, her worst fears were realized when she went into labor in July. With no supplies to safely assist Sogra, Atifa directed her to another clinic, around 2 hours away by car. I don't know if it happened on the way or at the clinic, Atifa says, but she lost her child. A few more colored photos accompany this article. One is a two-page spread, which I will read the caption of. There is no equipment, no people, no medications. The closure of the local clinic in Taiko, a mountainous community in Dikundi province, has left Zahira, who worked there as a cleaner, fearful both for her community and her own family, with Afghanistan's economy still in dire straits after the international troop withdrawal in 2021. She was the sole breadwinner in her household, which includes 5 young children. Okay, in the foreground, in the center, is this beautifully attired young woman. She's wearing white slacks. She's wearing sandals. They're very thickly soled, but they're the ones with the straps, two straps across the insole and then further up. I don't know if it's Velcro or a buckle. I can't see. Her dress, which is long-sleeved and goes below her knees, remembering, too, that she's already wearing white slacks. There's a lace inset on the cuffs and on the skirt, and it's a bright pink, purple, and yellow floral print on a green background. Then she has a head dress or attire on her head. To me, it looks like a huge red bandana with a black border. She's looking downward because she's holding a bundle in her arms, and it's a small child. I can see its little feet sticking out, but its little head and back are covered by a black cloth. The sky is blue in the background. There is one green bush in the mid-foreground. The rest is rock. I mean, this is a mountainous area. I once read that it was likened to Wyoming and that its climate is like Wyoming in the winter. This is not the Wyoming of the Grand Tetons, however, or any of those other lush high mountain ranges. This is desperate rock. It's just rock. And in the background, it is what looks no longer boulders in the background, I don't think, but it is mountainous and it's blonde. There's nothing green about it. It is not forested except by that one green bush. It is rock. Okay, I'm going to turn the page and read a couple more of these captions for these beautiful colored photographs. Okay, here's an adobe building. It looks like adobe. It's kind of a blondish tan color. And the doorway is edged in white, and it's turquoise. But in the doorway stands a woman, and she's attired in sapphire blue. It's a really fancy dress. Again, she has slacks on. They're blue. And then over that is this blue scalloped skirt with kind of a lace inset in a golden color, and she has a blue garment over her head. It's May Afraz, 25, pictured in her 9th month of pregnancy, fearful of the prospect of giving birth at home following the closure of her local family health clinic. I'm afraid for me and my baby, she says. The clinics that remain open are too far from her isolated Dikundi community. I am weak and cannot walk that far. We don't know what we will do. Okay, now, the next photo, and I think there are just two more left. If the clinic had been open, maybe things would have gone differently. Okay, this is actually a picture of Gulsum Akbari, a midwife. She's wearing a white lab coat over her dress, over dark-colored slacks. And she also wears a head covering and kind of a linen-like fabric. Behind her, again, are these tan walls. There's a clock on the wall, and there's a bed next to the wall. It looks kind of like a primitive hospital bed. It's covered in a white covering. Gulsum, a midwife, stands in her family health clinic, where the month before, in June, a patient from a distant community had suffered a stillbirth, something Akbari said might have been avoided if the pregnant woman still had access to a now-closed clinic near her home. Had the clinic been functioning, she would have received proper care beforehand, Akbari said. And here's a photograph of a man. He's seated on a lovely Oriental-style rug, red and black and beige. He's wearing a white cap, a small cap. He's dressed in dark blue. He's seated on the floor, and it looks like there are more men seated beyond him, and again, this tan-walled room. He's holding a long piece of paper. It's like it would be maybe two legal sheets fastened together. It's long. And he's wearing glasses, and he's holding up this paper. Who knows what will happen during the winter? Mohammed Nadir Sharifi, 55, a village elder in Taiko, holds up a letter he and other members of the local council of elders wrote to the authorities and humanitarian workers there, imploring them to reopen Taiko's family health clinic, now closed as a result of funding cuts. He looks very serious. He has graying hair under his small cap, graying facial hair, and he's wearing glasses. And one more, and we're back to this mountainous area that's just boulder and not very good-looking soil. Beautiful blue sky, though, with white clouds in the background. In the foreground is a woman. She's kind of kneeling, not really kneeling, but she's scrunched down on the ground, and she has one of her hands flat on the ground. She's wearing dark-colored pants, and I can see that there's a dress over the top that's in black and pink and yellow floral, and she's wearing a pink head covering. Mawash, 30. Uh-oh. She's holding her hand on the ground, as I said. Visits the grave of her stillborn child for the first time. She lost her baby in June, when after waiting for 2 hours outside her local health clinic in Daikundi, she realized the facility had been closed. By the time she reached a more distant facility, it was too late. Many women will lose their babies, she says. My request to the people and the government of the U.S. is this. Please reopen the clinic. The brief, Putin's Brush Off by Simon Schuster. The Kremlin appears in no rush to negotiate peace with Ukraine, despite Trump's efforts. It was around midnight in Moscow when Vladimir Putin took a call from the White House. President Donald Trump had just spent several hours, August 18, in meetings with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and seven other leaders from Europe who had come along in a frantic effort to shore up U.S. support for the Ukrainian position. Now Trump was telling Putin about what he believed needed to be the next step. The leaders of the warring sides, Trump said, should meet in person and try to make progress toward peace. Putin seemed to have other plans. After the call, the Kremlin issued a mealy-mouthed statement suggesting it might be worth exploring the possibility of raising the level of representatives in future peace talks, whatever that means. It seemed a long way from accepting Trump's suggestion that Putin himself sit down with Zelensky. On other points, too, the Russians reverted to their familiar methods of wartime diplomacy, making threats, issuing demands, playing for time. The threats from Moscow became especially aggressive when it came to the central questions of the closely watched talks at the White House. If a peace agreement were reached, how could it be secured? Who would guarantee the peace, and by what means? On these points, Trump seemed to move closer to the position of his European allies, We'll help them out with that, he said, during his press conference with Zelensky at the start of the marathon talks. We will give them very good protection, very good security. He even said the protections would be NATO-like, echoing the promises of several European members of the NATO alliance, who've expressed a willingness to secure any future peace deal in Ukraine using their own troops. Those statements began to approach what President Zelensky has long been seeking, a clear commitment from the U.S. and its allies that they would step in to defend Ukraine from any future Russian invasion. Without such a commitment from his allies, Zelensky has argued, Ukraine cannot agree to any peace deal because it would be based on little more than Putin's word. Trump's promise to help out with the future defense of Ukraine seemed like a tentative but tangible step on the path to real security guarantees. It was enough to provoke a furious response from Moscow. In another statement, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, any scenario involving NATO troops coming to Ukraine's defense in the future would risk an uncontrolled escalation of the conflict with unpredictable consequences. Any firm attempt to secure the peace, in other words, would only deepen the war. That warning did not leave Trump with any clear options for advancing the peace process beyond the latest stage of Russian obstructionism. In his concluding statement, after at least 5 hours of talks with the visiting leaders from Europe, Trump said he began the arrangements for a meeting between the leaders of Russia and Ukraine. But he did not say Putin had agreed to participate. On the crucial question of security guarantees for Ukraine, Trump also sounded a lot more circumspect as the long day of negotiations wound down. We discussed security guarantees for Ukraine. Which guarantees, which would be provided by the various European countries with a coordination with the United States of America. This sounded a lot less convincing than Trump's suggestion earlier in the day that Ukraine would receive a NATO-like commitment to its security. But given the pushback he got from Kremlin, Trump did not have room to promise much more. After his summit with Putin in Alaska August 15, he'd already set aside his main source of leverage over the Russians, the threat of sanctions and tariffs that could weaken Putin's economy. We do not have to think about that right now, Trump remarked at the time. Secretary of State Marco Rubio later confirmed the threat of sanctions against Russia was off the table for now. I do not think new sanctions on Russia are going to force them to accept ceasefire, Rubio said on NBC's Meet the Press, August 17. But Trump may have no other means of bringing Russia's leaders to the negotiating table. Their intent to continue the war in Ukraine has come through loud and clear in their statements, and in one case, their fashion choices. Arriving for the summit with Trump in Alaska, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had the letters USSR written across the front of his sweater. He later insisted on Russian state TV there was nothing imperialistic about the message. But when asked about Putin's readiness to meet with Zelensky, the minister deflected. Any such summit, Lavrov said, would need to be organized step by step, gradually, starting with the expert level and going through all the necessary stages. Russia, in other words, is in no hurry to talk about peace. Unless Trump changes that dynamic, and reviving the threat of economic sanctions is his best option for doing that, the status quo seems unlikely to change anytime soon. In this edition of Time, Time has published the 100 most influential people in artificial intelligence. I'm going to read just a couple of those for you. Lang Wenfeng, CEO DeepSeek. January 20, Lian Wangfeng's Chinese AI startup DeepSeek released R1, the first open-weight model that challenged rival OpenAI's then newest release. Headlines seized upon DeepSeek's modest $6 million training cost, casting doubt on megaprojects like OpenAI's $500 billion AI infrastructure plan, Stargate. Frantic investors dumped American tech stocks. But while R1 was impressive, the narrative was incomplete. The $6 million figure did not include the roughly $1.6 billion cost of its cluster of computing chips, according to research firm SemiAnalysis, nor the generous salaries DeepSeek reportedly pays its researchers. C.C. Wei, WEI, Chairman and CEO, TSMC. TSMC produces bleeding-edge semiconductors for NVIDIA and AMD, among others. C.C. Wei's role has taken on geopolitical significance amid U.S. export controls on chips. In March, TSMC announced an additional $100 billion investment in advanced semiconductor manufacturing in the U.S. on top of a $65 billion investment in Phoenix. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.